She understood what was said about Fremen. They were not supposed to have a conscience, having lost it in a burning for revenge against those who had driven them from planet to planet in the long wandering. That was foolishness, of course. Only the rawest primitive had no conscience. Fremen possessed a highly evolved conscience, which centered on their own welfare as a people. It was only to outsiders that they seemed brutish, just as outsiders appeared brutish to Fremen. Every Fremen knew very well that he could do a brutal thing and feel no guilt. Fremen did not feel guilt for the same things that arouse such feelings in others. Their rituals provided a freedom from guilts which might otherwise have destroyed them. They knew in their deepest awareness that any transgression could be ascribed, at least in part, to well-recognized extenuating circumstances. The failure of authority, or a natural bad tendency, shared by all humans, or to bad luck, which any sentient creature should be able to identify as a collision between mortal flesh and the outer chaos of the universe. In this context, Ganima felt herself to be the pure Fremen, a carefully prepared extension of tribal brutality. She needed only a target, and that, obviously, was House Carino. She longed to see Ferodin's blood spilled on the ground at her feet. No enemy awaited her at the Khanat. Even the search parties had gone elsewhere. She crossed the water on an earth bridge, crept through tall grass toward the covert exit of the siege. Abruptly, light flared ahead of her, and Ganima threw herself flat on the ground. She peered out through stalks of giant alfalfa. A woman had entered the covert passage from the outside, and someone had remembered to prepare that passage in the way any siege entrance should be prepared. In troubled times, one greeted anyone entering the siege with bright light, temporarily blinding the newcomer and giving guards time to decide. But such a greeting was never meant to be broadcast out over the desert. The light visible here meant the outer seals had been left aside. Ganima felt a tug of bitterness at this betrayal of siege security, this flowing light. The ways of the lace-shirt Fremen were to be found everywhere. The light continued to throw its fan over the ground at the cliff base. A young girl ran out of the orchard's darkness into the light, something fearful about her movements. Ganima could see the bright circle of a glow-globe within the passage, a halo of insects around it. The light illuminated two dark shadows in the passage, a man and the girl. They were holding hands as they stared into each other's eyes. Ganima sensed something wrong about the man and woman there. They were not just two lovers stealing a moment from the search. The light was suspended above and beyond them in the passage. The two talked against a glowing arch, throwing their shadows into the outer night where anyone could be a watcher of their movements. Now and again the man would free a hand. The hand would come gesturing into the light, a sharp and furtive movement which, once completed, returned to the shadows. Lonely sounds of night creatures filled the darkness around Ganima, but she screened out such distractions. What was it about those two? The man's motions were so static, so careful. He turned. Reflection from the woman's robe illuminated him, exposing a raw red face with a large blotchy nose. Ganima drew in a deep, silent breath of recognition.
Palim Pasha!
He was a grandson of a Naib whose sons had fallen in Atreides' service. The face, and another thing revealed by the open swinging of his robe as he turned, drew for Ganima a complete picture. He wore a belt beneath the robe, and attached to the belt was a box which glistened with keys and dials. It was an instrument of the Talayalaxu or the Ixians for certain, and it had to be the transmitter which had released the tigers. Palim Pasha. This meant that another Naibate family had gone over to House Carino. Who was the woman, then? No matter. She was someone being used by Palim Pasha. Unbidden, a Bene Gesserit thought came into Ganima's mind.
Each planet has its own period, and each life likewise.
She recalled Palim Pasha well, watching him there with that woman, seeing the transmitter, the furtive movements. Palim Pasha taught in the siege school. Mathematics. The man was a mathematical boor. He had attempted to explain Muad'Dib through mathematics until censured by the priesthood. He was a mind-slaver, and his enslaving process could be understood with extreme simplicity. He transferred technical knowledge without a transfer of values.
I should have suspected him earlier, she thought. The signs were all there.
Then, with an acid tightening of her stomach,
he killed my brother!
She forced herself to calmness. Palim Pasha would kill her, too, if she tried to pass him there in the covert passage. Now she understood the reason for this un-Fremen display of light, this betrayal of the hidden entrance. They were watching by that light to see if either of their victims had escaped. It must be a terrible time of waiting for them, not knowing. And now that Ganima had seen the transmitter, she could explain certain of the hand motions. Pauline Basha was depressing one of the transmitter's keys frequently, an angry gesture. The presence of this pair said much to Ganima. Likely every way into the siege carried a similar watcher in its depths. She scratched her nose where dust tickled it. Her wounded leg still throbbed, and the knife arm ached when it didn't burn. The fingers remained numb. Should it come to a knife, she would have to use the blade in her left hand. Ganima thought of using the Mala pistol, but its characteristic sound would be sure to attract unwanted attention. Some other way would have to be found. Pauline Basha turned away from the entrance once more. He was a dark object against the light. The woman turned her attention to the outer night while she talked. There was a trained alertness about the woman, a sense that she knew how to look into the shadows, using the edges of her eyes. She was more than just a useful tool, then. She was part of the deeper conspiracy. Ganima recalled now that Pauline Basha aspired to be a K-Makam, a political governor under the Regency. He would be part of a larger plan, that was clear. There would be many others with him, even here in Tabor. Ganima examined the edges of the problem thus exposed, probed into it. If she could take one of these guardians alive, many others would be forfeit. The whiffle of a small animal drinking at the connaught behind her caught Ganima's awareness. Natural sounds and natural things. Her memory searched through a strange, silent barrier in her mind, found a priestess of Jalth captured in Assyria by Sennacherib. The memories of that priestess told Ganima what would have to be done here. Pauline Basha and his woman there were mere children, wayward and dangerous. They knew nothing of Jalth, knew not even the name of the planet where Sennacherib and the priestess had faded into dust. The thing which was about to happen to the pair of conspirators, if it were explained to them, could only be explained in terms of beginning here, and ending here. Rolling onto her side, Ganima freed her Fremkit, slipped the sand snorkel from its bindings. She uncapped the sand snorkel, removed the long filter within it. Now she had an open tube. She selected a needle from the repair pack, unsheathed a kris knife, and inserted the needle into the poison hollow at the knife's tip, that place where once a sandworm's nerve had fitted. Her injured arm made the work difficult. She moved carefully and slowly, handling the poisoned needle with caution while she took a wad of spice fiber from its chamber in the kit. The needle's shank fitted tightly into the fiber wad, forming a missile which went tightly into the tube of the sand snorkel. Holding the weapon flat, Ganima wormed her way closer to the light, moving slowly to cause minimal disturbance in the alfalfa. As she moved, she studied the insects around the light. Yes, there were Payum flies in that fluttering mob. They were notorious biters of human flesh. The poisoned dart might go unnoticed, swatted aside as a biting fly. A decision remained. Which one of those two to take, the man or the woman?
Maurice.
The name came unbidden into Ganima's mind. That was the woman's name. It recalled things said about her. She was one of those who fluttered around Pauline Basha as the insects fluttered around the light. She was easily swayed, a weak one. Very well. Pauline Basha had chosen the wrong companion for this night. Ganima put the tube to her mouth, and, with the memory of the priestess of Jalth clearly in her awareness, she sighted carefully, expelled her breath in one strong surge. Pauline Basha batted at his cheek, drew away a hand with a speck of blood on it. The needle was nowhere to be seen, flicked away by the motion of his own hand. The woman said something soothing, and Pauline Basha laughed. As he laughed, his legs began to give away beneath him. He sagged against the woman, who tried to support him. She was still staggering with the dead weight when Ganima came up beside her and pressed the point of an unsheathed kris knife against her waist. In a conversational tone, Ganima said,
"Make no sudden moves, Maurice. My knife is poisoned. You may let go of Pauline Basha now. He is dead."
In all major socializing forces, you will find an underlying movement to gain and maintain power through the use of words. From witch doctor to priest to bureaucrat, it is all the same. A governed populace must be conditioned to accept power words as actual things, to confuse the symbolized system with the tangible universe. In the maintenance of such a power structure, certain symbols are kept out of the reach of common understanding, symbols such as those dealing with economic manipulation, or those which define the local interpretation of sanity. Symbol secrecy of this form leads to the development of fragmented sublanguages, each being a signal that its users are accumulating some form of power. With this insight into a power process, our Imperial Security Force must be ever alert to the formation of sub-languages.
Lecture to the Arrakeen War College by the Princess Irulan.
"It is perhaps unnecessary to tell you," Faradin said, "but to avoid any errors,
I'll announce that a mute has been stationed with orders to kill you both, should I show signs of succumbing to witchery."
He did not expect to see any effect from these words. Both the Lady Jessica and Idaho gratified his expectations. Faradin had chosen with care the setting for this first examination of the pair, Shaddam's old state audience chamber. What it lacked in grandeur, it made up for with exotic appointments. Outside it was a winter afternoon, but the windowless chamber's lighting simulated a timeless summer day, bathed in golden light from artfully scattered glow-globes of the purest Ixian crystal. The news from Arrakis filled Faradin with quiet elation. Leto, the male twin, was dead, killed by an assassin tiger. Ganima, the surviving sister, was in the custody of her aunt, and reputedly was a hostage. The full report did much to explain the presence of Idaho and the Lady Jessica. Sanctuary was what they wanted. Carino's spies reported an uneasy truce on Arrakis. Alia had agreed to submit herself to a test called the Trial of Possession, the purpose of which had not been fully explained. However, no date had been set for this trial, and two Carino spies believed it might never take place. This much was certain, though. There had been fighting between Desert Fremen and the Imperial Military Fremen, an abortive civil war which had brought government to a temporary standstill. Stilgar's holdings were now neutral ground, designated after an exchange of hostages. Ganima evidently had been considered one of these hostages, although the working of this remained unclear. Jessica and Idaho had been brought to the audience securely bound in suspensor chairs. Both were held down by deadly thin strands of shigawire, which would cut flesh at the slightest struggle. Two Sardaukar troopers had brought them, checked the bindings, and had gone away silently. The warning had indeed been unnecessary. Jessica had seen the armed mute standing against the wall at her right, an old but efficient projectile weapon in his hand. She allowed her gaze to roam over the room's exotic inlays. The broad leaves of the rare iron bush had been set with eye pearls and interlaced to form the center crescent of the dome ceiling. The floor beneath her was alternate blocks of diamond wood and kabuzu shell, arranged within rectangular borders of passiquet bones. These had been set on end, laser-cut and polished. Selected hard materials decorated the walls in stress-woven patterns which outlined the four positions of the lion symbol claimed by descendants of the late Shaddam IV. The lions were executed in wild gold. Faradin had chosen to receive the captives while standing. He wore uniform shorts and a light golden jacket of elf silk open at the throat. His only decoration was the princely starburst of his royal family worn at the left breast. He was attended by the Bashar Titanic wearing Sardaukar dress tans and heavy boots, an ornate laser gun carried in a front holster at the belt buckle. Titanic, whose heavy visage was known to Jessica from Bene Gesserit reports, stood 3 paces to the left and slightly behind Faradin. A single throne of dark wood sat on the floor near the wall directly behind the two.
"Now," Faradin said, addressing Jessica, "do you have anything to say?" "I would inquire why we are bound thus," Jessica said, indicating the shigawire. "We have only just now received reports from Arrakis to explain your presence here," Faradin said. "Perhaps I'll have you released presently." He smiled. "If you..."
He broke off as his mother entered by the state doors behind the captives. When Sissia hurried past Jessica and Idaho without a glance, presented a small message cube to Faradin, actuated it. He studied the glowing face, glancing occasionally at Jessica, back to the cube. The glowing face went dark, and he returned the cube to his mother, indicated that she should show it to Titanic. While she was doing this, he scowled at Jessica. Presently, when Sissia stationed herself at Faradin's right hand, the darkened cube in her hand, partly concealed in a fold of her white gown, Jessica glanced to her right at Idaho, but he refused to meet her gaze.
"The Bene Gesserit are displeased with me," Faradin said. "They believe I was responsible for the death of your grandson."
Jessica held her face emotionless, thinking,
"So Ganima's story is to be trusted, unless..."
She didn't like the suspected unknowns. Idaho closed his eyes, opened them to glance at Jessica. She continued to stare at Faradin. Idaho had told her about this Rajia vision, but she'd seemed unworried. He didn't know how to catalog her lack of emotion. She obviously knew something, though, that she wasn't revealing.
"This is the situation," Faradin said, and he proceeded to explain everything he'd learned about events on Arrakis, leaving out nothing. He concluded, "Your granddaughter survives, but she's reportedly in the custody of the Lady Alia. This should gratify you." "Did you kill my grandson?" Jessica asked.